closer. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 14 of Hold That Thought with David Brimer. This is David's second time on Hold That Thought. And every time we get together, we kind of just go all over the map and talk about a little bit about everything. He is probably one of my favorite people to just sit back and converse about the media, music, movie, book industry. I love talking with this guy. In this episode in particular, we rapped about accomplishing goals, failures, Marcel the Drunkard, the idea book, music, film, literature, writing a screenplay, getting your ideas on paper, Spotify, and much, much more. Here it is, episode 14 with David Brimer. Welcome, everybody, to Hold That Thought, episode 14 with David Brimer. I'm in Lakeland, Florida at the Brimer Studio. Dave, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming, man.
Awesome, man. It's always a pleasure. In this episode, we're going to speak about accomplishing goals inside the music industry and outside the music industry, but more importantly, how to get through all those projects. In 2017, Brimer played a combination of 103 gigs, which took place all the way from Connecticut to Georgia. As part of them were as a tour. He did a lot of tributes, which included the Stones, Hendrix, Petty, and the Beatles, correct?
Yeah.
He also produced his first all-jazz album, two EPs, and a single. And get this, he managed to produce a screenplay, which was a finalist on 13horror.com, which does a huge screenplay contest every single year, and he was a finalist. He wrote a novel, and believe it or not, folks, he got married all in the same year. Looking back, I got married 8-9 years ago. Carrie, if you're listening, I always forget about this. But anyways, 8-9 years ago, and just looking back at the year that I got married, just getting married that year was plenty enough for me to accomplish. So the fact that you were able to produce so much, how did you do it?
Well, thankfully, 2017 was the year that I could really make a good, solid living playing and just playing. So, you know, one of the real keys was that I had the time. You know, I was lucky enough to have the time to do all that stuff. But of course, when you think about it, everybody has the time. That's just what you choose to do with said time. And, you know, it was the creative urge within me is always really strong. My wife says I have adult ADHD, so that I'm constantly, you know, moving from different things. So I would work on 3 or 4 different projects every single day by segmenting out my day. Like, for example, when I was working on the novel, I would get up in the morning and write like 1,000 words a day. I always kind of thought about what famous writers wrote per day. You know, there's always this urge with writers to, you know, take it like a job and work a certain amount every single day. So I tried to do that with the writing. And then I would work on the music here as well. So I would write for a few hours, and then I'd go and I'd work on the music for a few hours, and then play a gig at night. And in the meantime, on the days when I was creatively stuck and I couldn't work on that stuff, I would work on booking gigs, work on videos and trying to further that part of the career.
The business side.
Yeah. That way I'm always working on something that's going to be pushing me forward. Sadly, the least important thing was the stuff that I was doing toward my degree, like classes and forum posts and stuff like that. So, I still had to find time to do that and also find time to have a family life. So it was really all about just breaking the days apart and organizing.
Segmenting them and being able to flow. Did you find that on days that you were stuck creatively and that you either had writer's block or you just weren't in the mood to actually pick up the guitar or the drums or the keys and play, and you went to the business side, when that happens, do you get to a point where when you're working on the business side that you're still thinking about the creative side?
Yeah, because they're interrelated. They should be interrelated if you're in a creative business. My cat is literally drinking coffee right now. I do not want to know what that's going to be like in like 20 minutes.
Ow! We may do another Instagram post on this.
But, you know, like finding gigs is so involves so much creativity. Getting people to recognize you and recognize your talent.
I've never heard anyone put it that way. Finding gigs involves creativity.
Well, think about these days. That what do you have to do to get one of your artists a gig? You don't just say, "Hey, you need to check this person out." You send them a video, you send them recordings, you send them EPKs, you send them all these things that were made creatively to push you forward, because we can't go on anyone's
word. But we think about it on a business aspect. We don't think about it on a creative aspect, and maybe that's what's holding us back.
Yeah, there's definitely that, because I find sometimes when I'm working on a video and I'm not feeling all that creative, that it doesn't always come out so well, because I'm just chalking it out there so that I can have something new for people to see. A lot of times I cheat at gigs because I have a really nice camera that I could set up on a tripod in the back of the room, get great video. But I cheat, I get lazy and end up putting my iPhone up and it, you know, gets rumbled by the speakers and falls over in the first song. So if we did think about it in more of a creative, interesting way, you get better results. You always get better results.
There's a book I'm reading, and it's called The Idea Book. And The Idea Book is based on telling you a short story and giving you an activity or exercise to do. And I encourage everyone to pick up this book, because the book will help you think outside your normal patterns. And when I'm soliciting for events and festivals, I can't send the same email that another agency is sending. I can't send the same email that a musician's sending. It has to be different. Everything about it has to be different, or I'm not going to have an opportunity to work with the people. I have to show them that my company is different. I don't try to be like the competition, because I don't want to be like the competition. I want to be different. Before we move on to the creative aspect, because you and I are going to be able to talk for a long time about this, I want to just take a step back. Are there any particular things that you do that has given you an opportunity to accomplish producing that? Because last year I put the mixtape series together.
Mm-hmm.
I don't play music. I didn't record the music. I helped orchestrate 12 bands, got them into WM&F, put the CD together. My good friend Rob K helped engineer and master it a little bit. I didn't really give him much to work with, and he did an amazing job, seeing that it was a lot of volunteers had their hands on it.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of work to get that accomplished. What kept you focused to produce an all jazz album, which is Mulberry, right? Which is completely badass. I'm a big fusion fan, by the way. And check it out. It's on YouTube. And it's on multiple forms on YouTube, so you can't miss it. It's amazing. But you produce that, two EPs in a single. Where did the motive... Wait, how did you get... How did you finish these projects? Because that is... One for me was a struggle.
I've always had this creative monkey on my back, for lack of a better term. I'm constantly being pushed to move to the next thing, move to the next thing, move to the next thing, get stuff out there, play, record. You know, it's like it never shuts off, you know? My brain is constantly coming up with new ideas and creative things. And
mine's similar. Always rolling.
Yeah. And I mean, I can't sleep at night sometimes because it just keeps going and going. Like last night, I got up to use the bathroom in the middle of the night and my brain woke up and it took me at least an hour to get it to calm down to sleep again. Because I'm just thinking of different things. But I love and I live in the arts. And so I'm constantly wanting to be a part of everything that I love. And I have to rein that in sometimes because my big three passions in life are music, film, and literature. And my natural response is that I want to be a part of all of that. So luckily I was blessed with the talent to be a musician, and I've worked that side the best, and that's where I feel like I shine the most. But you know, I started as a writer, so I've always written. I have, you know, things, books that I tried to write from before I even started playing the guitar. So I've always been wanting to write, you know, the perfect novel, and I've tried and failed so many times.
What have you learned from that failure?
I learned how to
besides becoming a better writer.
I learned how to kind of focus on what makes a good novel or a good short story. Most of that comes from just reading. Same with music. You know, what makes a good song? I don't know. Listen to good songs. Take it apart. Find out.
Break it down.
What is it about that song that makes it so good? What is it about that book? What is it about the writing style? What is it about the prose itself? You know, I started as a very flowery writer. Like my biggest influence when I was younger was F. Scott Fitzgerald. He was a very flowery writer. And as I've grown older and as I've honed my skill more, I've become more like an Ernest Hemingway, who's a very direct and pointed writer. There's not a whole lot of flowery over description. It's just enough to put you there and get to the meat of it. And through that, you know, that's how my writing has gotten better. And then I branched into the screenplay thing because I'm just not about to get into being a cinematographer and making movies as much as I want to do that. It's just I know I don't have the talent to really excel in that, because if I'm going to do something, I have to excel at it. I'm not going to get into anything halfway. It has to be something where I know I can get to the top of the mountain of that. And so that's where I started writing screenplays as a way to get into my love of film while still being true to something that I'm good at, which is the writing. And then I wrote a screenplay 2 years ago that was a good kind of, okay, I've done that. It's okay, but it's not great. Now I have another story that was, it was just the crumb of an idea that I thought was so unique, because it's a horror film. Horror is something that's so played. Every horror story has been told. And I thought about, how do I take this, what I'm good at, music, put it into a story and make it this kind of unique take on a very common theme, which is, you know, the serial killer. So I made a story about a musician, like a songwriter, who accidentally murders a prostitute, and it inspires him to write a song that becomes a huge hit. But he's so creatively blocked, they can't come up with another hit. And so he thinks the only way to get that inspiration is to kill again. And that inspires him to become a serial killer. So it's really not like incredibly violent.
Is this the one that just became a finalist in 13 Horror?
Yeah.
Okay.
They when I submitted it, they sent me back a 2-page critique. And they pointed out all the things that I had done wrong. But at the end, they said that, you know, the story is incredible. The dialogue is incredible. Fix these things. Download this Adobe story so that you format it in the professional manner. Do all this stuff and you'll have a, you know, grade A screenplay. They compared it to Elmore Leonard, which I thought was pretty cool.
That's awesome. Once you get that corrected, you can submit it again.
I submitted it again and then became a finalist.
That's awesome.
So, hey,
congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you.
That is amazing.
It's now, that screenplay is now in the Blue Cat screenplay contest, which will announce its finalists in January 31st, I think. And then I also submitted it to Cannes as of the Cannes Film Festival. So I'm going to keep submitting it and keep just trying to get it out there and keeping it out there. And, you know, there's a lesson to be learned from this in any kind of art form, is that, you know, you learn from the critique, and you
I don't think a lot of people can handle the critique sometimes. I think that is a mental blockage, whether it's accomplishing your goals or not. If you're set out to put a project together and you're gung-ho, I see guys all the time trying to come up with these great creative projects. And then I follow up with them and something happened. I don't know exactly what happened, but they stopped.
It's a lack of follow through.
And I've started implementing failure first. Have you heard of this design?
I haven't heard of it as a specific design, but I think
so. There was a guy who did a TED Talk. I don't recall his name. I could find it up and add it in the show notes. He worked for Google X, and anytime Google X launched a project, they looked at failure first. So the board of directors would put a project down, and we want solar panels on top of the submarine. Now, whatever crazy idea they had. But before we do this, I want you to make a list of everything that we can fail at. Most people, when they start a project, most people, when they start a business, relationship, anything, they're looking at succeeding. They are thinking about succeeding. They are thinking about getting through the checkered flag, getting the trophy, whatever it may be, accomplishing their goal. Very rarely do people go, before I open this bar, before I launch this music program, before I try to record, what can I fail at?
How many ways can this possibly fail?
So what you do is you get a paper, pen, and you make a list. Okay, if I'm going to open up a music venue, I can fail by not marketing. I can fail by not advertising. I can fail by not having the right music in there. I can fail by not treating the musicians right, by not having a sound tech, by having 60 flat screen TVs. And when you actually look at that on paper, then you can go back and go, okay, can I fix this problem? Well, I don't know much about marketing. Maybe I can hire someone. Okay, if I can hire someone, does it fit within our budget? Okay, if it's in our budget, we can fix marketing. Can I fix having a stage? Well, there's just no room in this place for a stage. So it's not going to be a true music venue. You start going down that list and figuring out what you can fix and what you can't fix. And if the majority of them you can't fix, then it's not worth pursuing the project. And so instead of you fail right away, yeah. but you fail without losing money. And you have a sense of, you go in with a sense going, okay, I did, you know, this project's not going to work, but I didn't fail at it because I took a really in-depth look at it and knew that right now is not the time and I can't make this happen.
But you could probably take that and go, there's a lot of good ideas within this and move that on to the next project.
Absolutely.
Because you're not losing anything substantial like finances.
You're not losing time. You're not losing money.
You're just losing idea time, which is fine because that's endless. You say, you know, you're looking at opening a music venue and you have this space that's open to you. And so, you know, it's the rent is perfect. And so, you know, the idea of moving in is feasible. But you can't manage to come up with the right way to do it, the way you want to do it, ideally in your head. It doesn't fit in with that. Doesn't mean that you completely abandon the idea. It means that you move on to another one, come up with, you know, okay, how did it, because it didn't work there, how can I make it work here? Or,
how can you take that knowledge of what you learn from looking at the failures first and apply it to your next project? And that's what Google, the whole TED video on Google X was, okay, we just went on, the solar panels on the submarine are not going to work. Let's move to the next project and let's see if we can make this project. And they went from project to project and it was an idea board. Mm-hmm. I would love to be on that. On that board, just sitting there spitting out ideas, crazy ideas, and hey, let's try this, you know.
let's put sonar on sharks.
Yes. But there's a lesson to be learned, and I think any artist, musician, videographer, start looking at your projects beforehand, figuring out, even time-wise, do I have time to put this album together?
Yeah.
Should I take this project on? You took on a lot of projects this year and you're able to pump them out. Most people can't even produce a quarter of what you were able to produce.
I rarely planned any of them. I kind of just fell into most of it because it's sort of natural. And I can't say that everything I did was completely successful because, you know, the Mulberry EP is thankfully I had the Marcel the Drunkard, shout out to him.
Can you explain this story? This is great.
This guy, he's European, I'm pretty sure, because most of his fan base is European. I'm getting a lot of plays in Belgium right now, which is cool. But, this guy just contacted me out of the blue saying that he had listened to my record, which is something that the Mulberry record was started out as a completely different project. I started 2017 by wanting to make a rock record. And I went in to my other studio in Winter Haven where the drums are, and I basically recorded like 12 to 15 just drum tracks, improvised. You know, I'd have like an idea in my head that I'd hum along to while I was recording the drums to a click track. And then I would wait a day or two, and I would look at the drum, and I would write a song around the drums. And I wrote a lot of stuff, and it just sat there. I got all this music, and then there was just no lyrical ideas came to mind. I was so blocked. I couldn't come up with anything. So it stalled around May or June. And then I started to reappraise some of the tracks and look at them from an instrumental standpoint, and a few of them came together. And honestly, it's funny. I put Mulberry out, but I wasn't all that fond of it. There's some good stuff on it, but it's not anywhere near my favorites of the things that I've done. But out of the blue, this guy, Marcel the Drunkard, who's got this huge YouTube fan base, he basically posts albums on his
If I'm not mistaken, he's got like something like 70,000 subscribers on his YouTube channel. Whatever it is, it's ridiculously high.
It's a lot. And so he asked me to post if he could post my record. And I didn't even – I was like, sure, what the hell. It's not going to do me any harm. So he does it, and then within a week, the views were over 1,000. And it's only been up for like 3 or 4 weeks now, and it's close to 2,000 views. Like, it's a lot. 80 likes, you know, 3 or 4 comments. And that reach is something that I would have never, ever, ever even gotten close to on my own, because my fan base doesn't know my original side and my jazz and fusion records, because I don't play that stuff live, because I can't, because there's like 4 people in this town who would come and see it. So I have to rely on a completely different fan base when it comes to my recordings. And that one video has opened me up to a whole bunch of people who have come out of the woodworks and listened to my stuff. And it was an album that I just sort of put out there and wasn't all that into. I didn't promote it. I didn't promote it at all, because I knew that these were good songs, or at least they were good enough. And I just wanted to put it out there and be done with it so I can move on to the next thing. Which, you know, I've recorded since then. I've done a whole another record that's going to come out in February. But that stuff comes so quickly because it's mostly improvised. And is very, very much of the Miles Davis ethos. And that it's, you know, the first idea is the best idea. And you just sort of, you go with that. So I'll approach a song. And I'll give it a few tries. And if it's not there, I'll step away.
Step away.
And then I'll come back to it. And usually that first freshest idea is the one that makes the record. So that kind of just, you know, that makes it easier to put the records out. But it's still, there's so much stuff that doesn't make it, because I'm constantly recording. Constantly. Because I love it. It's one of my joys in life is to create music.
That's awesome.
And so I'm constantly doing it because I enjoy the process. And I'm not even really all that into the end result, because I enjoy the process.
The process.
And I think that is really the key to achieving so many projects, is that you have to enjoy the process of making it. You know, a lot of times you hear people who talk about, you know, like the courting phase of when they were trying to get their wife, and they look back on the phase when they didn't have it and they were working toward it as being, you know, at the time you wanted that to be over, but then you look back on it, you're like, that was the best time of all. I feel that way when I'm creating, because I enjoy the process so much. I enjoy getting up and writing a story that gets my emotions going. It's like, I want to be able to, I don't even know what this character is going to do. I'm just, you know, it's just writing itself, and I'm enjoying it. And that's when the good stuff comes out. Editing it later, you got to put a gun to my head to go back to it, because it's done. It's out.
Well, it's similar to having conversations on this podcast. It's amazing. I get to meet so many cool people and get to talk to them and hear so much creative stuff. And then it's like, okay, I got a week to edit this podcast and get it up. And it's like, oh God, the editing process is just not fun. Thinking about what I'm going to talk to you about, researching your music, that's just great. It's similar to what I've experienced with painting. Over the last couple of years, I've got into painting, and I've got to the point where maybe I paint once every 2 weeks. But when it hits me and I actually sit down and start painting, I am in a zone.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot distract me whatsoever. I created a birthday present for Carrie, and it was five small canvases. And my wife loves birds. And it just out of the blue came to me, and I was able to create five different scenes on these five small canvases. And I don't particularly know where the idea came from. Mm-hmm. It was a moment, I would say, once I get in the actual moment and I sit down and I start painting and I don't think about anything, it just flows. It comes out and it's amazing. And I see the same process with my daughters. Like, my daughters will be running around crazy throughout the house. Kids want to have art class, and we sit down with them and they start painting or drawing, and they are in a zone, and it's like a beautiful meditation state. Mm-hmm. And it's cool to see what gets produced. And sometimes I even shock myself. I'm looking at it going, well, it's not the greatest art, but it's pretty creative, and I don't know where that came from.
And it moves you in a certain way.
Yeah, it really does. And that's my goals. One of my goals in 2018 is to write more and to paint more and draw more and just get more away from the computer, mm-hmm. and into creating. The problem is with society now and the way work's structured is I constantly live on the computer, and I'm trying to get away from that.
I know, but you know, unfortunately, with what we do, is it's so reliant upon the computer. We live on the internet because our whole life, our whole career is on the internet. It's even though our career doesn't happen on the internet, you know, it happens out in public in front of people. It's still, if we didn't have the internet, my gigs would be. I can't even imagine having to get every bar club owner at the end of the gig with my calendar saying, all right, when can we book the next one? They're usually gone by that point. It's just, now there are some bar owners that I still deal that way with. In fact, there's one locally who prefers phone calls. And I think that's cool. You know, it's not like a Facebook message, which is kind of the most common. Hey, are you available? Blah, 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 blah. Is what I get most of the time. But with Leo, it's a phone call, which I think is cool. Or at the end of the gig with my calendar, go back in the office and compare calendars. Because I don't do that Google Calendar crap. I have a physical calendar with a pen that I write in. Because if I actually physically write it down, I tend to not forget it. But if someone texts me, hey, can you play Friday? And I don't immediately put it in my Google Calendar, I will probably forget. But because I go and I write it down, and I get a little bit of joy out of seeing my calendar get filled up with all this ink, you know, I can look at a month like January where I have 12 gigs and be like, you know, that's what I want to see. It's like when you read a book and you have all those pages you've already read. It's to me, it's the same the progress. Kind of feeling. You can see the progress. You can see how you've grown. I can look at my last four calendars and just see how the gigs have increased and see my progress. It's
a beautiful thing to see your progress. And that's one of the things I focused on in 2016 and 2017 was journaling. And every day spending 15 minutes and writing down. And I did two types of journaling where I would write about my actual day itself, and then I did a gratitude journal, mm-hmm. Which I spoke about in the prelude to this episode, Life Hacks. And it does wonders when you actually write stuff down and you see stuff, and it helps you think about it more. It helps you perceive it more. Mm-hmm. Whereas you're constantly on the computer or constantly on the phone. It gets lost in translation, I think.
It's not even real. I mean, the digital thing is not, it's not real. It's an aberration. It's you can't physically touch it. So to me, it's not there. It's once it becomes physical, then it becomes real to me. I think that
I like that train of thought. I really do.
Because, like, we have all these people now, you know, the entire world, their music collection is fake. It is a digital processed recording. And I'm the same way, too. I have tons of records, but, you know, all my music is digital. Now, everyone's movie collection is digital. You don't own that stuff. You're borrowing it from someone who has the power to take it away from you. My 1,000 DVDs in there are mine. If I want to watch whatever it is I want to watch, I put it in my DVD player and I watch it. And I don't have to be a slave to the internet to have it. We get so lost in this, oh, everything's right at my fingertips. Spotify has everything. Well, guess what? Spotify doesn't work in Hiawassee, Georgia, when there's no internet.
Yeah.
But you know what does work? My Waves and MP3s that are on my hard drive, my records that play on my record player, those work. Because I'm not a slave to the internet.
It's a tough break between the two. Because if you want to succeed in the music industry and you really want to get your music out there, you have to have your music on Spotify. You have to have it on Pandora. You have to have it on YouTube so Marcel the Drunkard finds you.
Mm-hmm.
You have to utilize every single avenue. As a consumer, I completely get what you're saying. You don't want to be a slave to Netflix. You don't want to be a slave to Spotify. I prefer Spotify over Pandora. But my computer does not like Spotify. And they do not get along. And no matter what I've tried and what I've done, I've had technical issues with it. And the Spotify app crashes my Mac. So I don't have Spotify.
I think the idea behind Spotify is great. It's really awesome. Because you can find most everything. But you also can't find everything. And to me, I love that it's there. I feel like there's a place for it in the world. You know, it's kind of taken over for radio, really. Spotify playlists are more popular than radio. Same with YouTube playlists and stuff like that. But you can still be a collector of the physical and still have a... Because Spotify does pay musicians, but it's like...
Oh, yeah.
It's breadcrumbs.
Yeah.
You need to... Musicians need to... start getting paid for the product again. They need to, you know, put a premium on the
we're going to see a shift.
Yeah,
we are going to see a shift with the FCC and the internet. And I'd encourage all musicians to have tangible merchandise. Tangible, don't just, you know, yes, be on Spotify. Yes, sell your songs on iTunes. But have a CD. Or have vinyl, have something tangible, because we are getting ready to see a shift in the way the internet and the FCC are going to be working together. I don't know all the details on that. Who knows? But if you don't have a physical CD to sell someone, are you losing out on a sale?
Well, I can tell you right now, there is not a single person at a bar who loves your music who's going to go download your music afterwards. But they will buy your CD if they are... It's a moment thing.
Yes. They want the music right then and there. And if you do not have something tangible to sell them, a download card's not going to work. Because that download card's going to go in the junk drawer.
Yep.
Or the download card's going to go through the wash.
Yep. It's going to get forgotten as soon as they walk
out of
that bar.
It's going to get forgotten. But the chance... that you sell someone a CD, they get in their car, leave the bar, the CD's going to get played that night, or it's going to get played within the next couple days.
Most likely it's going to get opened and played on the way home.
For all your releases this year, was one of them Lady Moonbeam?
Yes.
And did you guys print CDs?
You know, what's funny is it was a battle, and we decided not to, because our first record, we printed 500 and we fell prey to the printed too many. And, you know, the problem with that was that Lady Moonbeam has not performed nearly as much as I have or my trio has, because, you know, the whole original music thing is you have a limited market. And if you're a professional musician who makes your living off of playing music, you can't devote too many big money-making Saturdays to playing gigs that you're not making any money on. It's kind of a crappy thing because, you know, I really enjoy Lady Moonbeam, and I think that it has all the possibility for popular success. You know, Lady Moonbeam is a very much of the now kind of band. But, you know, there just hasn't been enough demand because we haven't been playing the shows. So, you know, we had these conversations where everyone kind of agreed that right now it's all more about the Spotify's and the YouTubes. And so we have video, you know, we did a music video.
The music video came out great.
We did WMNF. We were their last Musicians Wanted band. And we've got three shows booked now in 2018. The plan is to have a lot more and get more out there. You know, the hell with the money, just get more exposure. But I personally want the physical. I really want the CD because I know that those sales will happen once those shows start going. And I feel like, you know, 100 CDs would be fine. But Marcus, our drummer and recording engineer, his thought, and I agree with him on this, is that we should wait and we should do a vinyl release. And because we can do a relatively inexpensive vinyl release, because the EP is only five songs, five very well-crafted songs that took a long time. But, you know, we could do a 12-inch with three songs on one side, two songs on the other, with just, doesn't even have to be a gatefold. It can just be a normal sleeve. And there's maybe more people might buy it as a vinyl as opposed to a CD. I feel like we should have both. Hell, I mean, people are even doing tapes now, which I think is retarded, but, you know, c'est la vie, hipsters do what they want to do. But, you know.
I'm cool with the vinyl tapes.
Tapes always sounded like crap. Like, why do you want to go there? It'd be like bringing VHS back. What do you want to have, those lines?
Yeah, I don't get that one.
It's a product of the younger generations looking up to the past generations and what they had. Like, the way vinyl is for people like me in the 30s, kids in their 18, 20, they're looking back at what we were using when we were their age, and it was Walkmans and VHS tapes. And so it's a cyclical thing, you know. Soon enough, kids are going to be digging up those old iPods, you know, the ones that are like that thick. Like, oh man, this is my iPod first generation, you know, and it's a reverence of the previous generation's things, and it's a cyclical thing that has always happened with human history.
You know, though, if it gets them listening to music,
I'm all for it. I think that having a healthy reverence for the past in any way, shape, or form is good, because, you know. How can you appreciate the fact that you can have every single song ever recorded right at your fingertips when you realize that what we had to do was tape the songs from the radio, and we could never get the beginning of the song because you weren't ready for your favorite song to come on until it already started playing? I mean, I still have mixtapes that I made for girls, you know, like these cultural things that don't exist anymore.
So, I just read a book, finished it right after the holiday, called Love is a Mixtape. The guy's name was Sheffield, and he was a writer for the Rolling Stones. He wrote this heartbreaking book about his wife that he fell in love with. They met in Charlottesville, he fell in love, and they fell in love over music. And it was just really interesting because he started making mixtapes for her. and they both realized they had this common love, which was music, and they had mixtapes for everything. And the book was awesome because you're like, oh, wow, I made a mixtape to go to the beach. I knew I was going to the beach that weekend with my friends and we were going to cut up, and I put some Bob Marley on it, and I don't even remember, you know, Jimmy Buffett or whatever else was on it. And I would have to definitely find those in my dad's garage somewhere. But he creates all these mixtapes for everything that he does with his wife. And his wife passes away after 5 years, just suddenly dies. And he's going through these tapes. And it's heartbreaking, but at the same time, it's like a lost love affair, mm-hmm. of remembering these times and remember that we really had a mixtape to do the laundry with. All these different scenarios, and you're sitting back, but it's a great read, very interesting read. Love is a mixtape.
Interesting.
So,
I feel like I made Rachel, my wife's, I feel like I made her mixtapes when we first started dating, but I feel like I might have, I might not have. It's hard to remember because it used to be a big thing.
Maybe you should get a tape player just to make her one.
Well, I made mix CDs.
Mix CDs.
We can at least go that far in advance.
So can you do that on Spotify now? Can you do that on Pandora?
Well, I think it's become the playlist. You know.
Can you create a playlist and send it to someone?
Yeah, you can. You can create a playlist and it'll have its own URL, I'm pretty sure.
There's something about connecting with your loved one or connecting with friends through music. An example, I have a good friend named Tony. And Tony's a little bit older. He's in his 50s. And we always talk about music. And he always brings me over a burnt CD. I was reading Music Aficionado a week ago, and that's when I came across the Dregs. And I'm like, have you heard of these guys? And he's like, of course I've heard of these guys. He's like, you were 4 years old at the time. That's why you didn't hear of them. He goes, I'll be over Wednesday. And sure enough, Wednesday he showed up and he burnt me the best of.
All right.
And he's my go-to guy. I can talk to him about any music, but those conversations are lost these days.
Yeah, I have those conversations with my dad. We, growing up, you know, my dad's the one who got me into all the music that I'm into. And growing up, we would do this thing called Stump the Chump. And it would be, you know, I would have discovered something new and I'd play it for him, but I wouldn't tell him who it was. And he'd have to try and figure it out. And we would always do that. And now my father-in-law... we have the same musical interests, and my father-in-law is a musician too. So I have those conversations with him now as well. And we can always talk about like the obscure stuff that I'm into. And thankfully being a musician, I get all kinds of, musical conversations all the time, but I don't get turned on to music very often anymore. I usually have to be the one who turns people on to music. And I turn myself on to music because I have this constant need for new. And that really, that goes back into the whole goal-oriented lifestyle of getting things done, is that I have a constant, insatiable urge for new. You know, I need something new.
That's what keeps your mind creative.
Mm-hmm.
Tonight I'm going to play pickleball. You ever heard of it?
I've heard of pickleball. Pickleball is like an old person's game of cricket or
in that. Table tennis.
Okay.
Ping pong, tennis, and they have it at the rec center. Every Thursday I go to Toastmasters and work on my public speaking for business and everything. And sure enough, one of the guys in my class plays pickleball, and half of them are like senior citizens. Half of them are like 30 and below. So I was like, I've never played before. And I like learning new things and keeping fresh. So I'm going to I'm going to go give it a shot. I'm probably get skunked by an 82-year-old, but
that's great. That's great. That's
who cares?
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm going to attempt it.
You should. I can't remember. It was not too long ago before I was playing basketball over at Kelly Rec, I'm a fat guy, so I don't have a lot of athletic ability, but I'm a good shot, and I enjoy sports, and when I am active, I like to play. And these kids, like high school kids, asked me to join their game to fill it out, and it was me and this scrawny little he couldn't have been more than 16. Little guy, like 80 pounds, soaking wet, against these two other kids who were roughly the same age, but one of them was kind of built like me. So we were already inherently at a disadvantage because, you know, he had the old guy who, you know, if you look at me, the very last thing you think is, oh, man, that guy's good at basketball. But we smoked him. That's awesome. I planted like threes and before I almost passed out. I mean, I could only last like 20, 30 minutes before I was done. I mean, I was done. But it was, you know, everything in my head is going, don't do this. You are going to hurt yourself. Don't do this. But, I was like, I want to do this. I want to try something new. I want to, you know, my wife convinced me to go to Vietnamese food. I'm a big Asian food fan, but I had never had Vietnamese food. And so she talked me into going to that. Now that's one of our favorite places to go.
How much different? I've never had it as well.
It's very like Thai. I think it's a okay. Lot. It's very similar
to Thai.
Really, you know, her family, they only, if we go out, it's almost always ethnic. You know, my father-in-law's favorite place to go is a Polish restaurant out in Clearwater called Pierogies, which is awesome. There's a place in town here called Cafe Zupina. And it's Ethiopian.
That's cool.
You know, things that are just out of the box, especially for a, you know, Central Floridian who is raised on barbecue and fried chicken.
If you're going to do anything, and if you're going to keep growing, not just as a musician, but as an individual.
As a person, yeah.
You have to step outside of your comfort zone.
And great topic there. If we, you know, pull it back into the music thing, stepping out of your comfort zone is the only way to move forward as a professional musician.
Absolutely. There's a quote that I live by: a comfort zone is a beautiful place, but nothing ever grows there.
Nope.
And you have to be willing to step outside and think outside the box. You can do this by journaling. You can do this by looking at other industries. Everyone looks at the music industry and they say, okay, well, all right, I'm an aspiring musician. I want to start playing, whether it be covers or originals. Here are my process. Here are my steps that I have to go through. The only step you need to worry about is rehearsing, fine-tuning, and having kick-ass music. The other steps, make your own road. Create your own road. Create your own path. Figure it out. You do not have, just because you're an original band, you do not have to go play that place in Orlando that is going to require you to bring 50 people out. And I don't know, maybe pay you $25, maybe pay you $50, depending on ticket sales. You don't have to go through that process anymore.
No, I'll say this right now. If you're an original band and you want to succeed, never, ever, ever, ever pay to play. Never, ever, 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 ever. It's a scam. Get out of it. If a guy's like, yeah, you could play here, but you got to buy 50 tickets from me and then sell them to make money, you're done. You're just done for.
Stop working with agents like that. Just stop working with them. Don't work with them. Do not go. There is a group out of Orlando, Cocoa Beach area, and I get their emails all the time. And I contacted the guy, and I forgot the name of the company. And he's like, yeah. He's like, we have five stages set up for this major festival on the beach. It's going to be X amount of people here, and it'll be $150 for... Wait, you're going to pay us $150? No. You're paying $150 to rent the stage. They do a similar thing in Nashville, where they have the one of the big music conferences, and they set up stages all down the streets in Nashville, and the musicians pay to rent the stage.
You just can't.
Busk, get up your ass and busk right next to the stage and piss off the promoter, because you should be getting paid, not the other way around.
Yeah, there's the thing that's not being realized in these pay-to-plays, and I run into this all the time with musicians around here, especially the younger ones who haven't been there, and they think that that's still a viable road, because there are a lot of promoters locally who will put you up at a theater opening for someone who has some sort of clout. But this one guy was saying they lost $1,000 to play a gig, to play a 30-minute gig that did absolutely nothing for them. Nothing at all. It's like you're already going to start in the hole. Like, what is that going to do for you? It does nothing.
It reminds me of the couple that gets married and spends $30,000, $40,000 on their wedding. You just started your relationship in the hole.
In a major hole.
In a major, major hole. Because you had to have the pretty dress, or you had to invite 150 people out. Don't do that to your band. Think about your band as a business.
Indeed.
Is this a good business move that we go pay? No, it's not a good business move. You do not need to pay. Now, the only way I would say paying for anything is if you're putting on your own event and your own festival. And that can be easily done, but you need to sit back. You need to look at your failures first. You need to see what vendors would be willing to sign on and see how much money you can make to put your own event. Like what we started talking about is creating your own community.
Mm-hmm.
Create your own community first, and then the money will start coming in. Don't pay anyone to play. That irks the shit out of me, and it irks me because why do people not know this?
How can anyone think that spending money to play a gig is a positive thing? I'm not trying to talk down to the bands that do this, because, you know, really, I feel like you're being swindled, and I'm on your side, because these promoters are swindling you. They're making a killing off of you not knowing any better. That's what they're banking on. That's why when you see the D-list 80s rock band that comes into town and has eight bands opening for it.
Yeah.
They're bands you've never heard of is because it's the garage band that this is their big break. They're going to open for Jackal, you know, or that's just one that came recently. And I heard about how much that these guys had to pay to open for these bands. And just now, if you are a band that has a following, like a good following, and you have to pay for 100 tickets, but you know you're going to sell all of those tickets and make a profit on it, that's a good business move. That's okay. But you have to know in advance that you're going to make all that money back.
And before you do that, hit Polestar up and check, get on Polestar and see what the headliner's normally selling around the country.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very resourceful website, because you can pull up Polestar and you could put in Badfish. Type in Badfish, and it'll bring up ticket sales for the last 10 years for Badfish all around the country. Okay, Badfish plays Janice once every year, and they typically sell 2,500 tickets. We can sell 100 tickets to that show to open up for them. Utilize those type of sources.
Yeah, it's... but more than anything, I feel like not going up, staying stable, is so much better than starting down. You know, if you're a local band, if you're a young band and you're an original band and you're staunch about that, playing a gig for nothing is so much better than playing a gig you had to pay for. Playing a gig for nothing in front of 10 people is so much better than playing a gig in front of 200 people that you had to pay for.
So let's jump into something real quick, because we're going to have to wrap this episode up shortly. Do you have to play for nothing? So an example, there are farmer markets and crafts and art festivals, and Florida probably owns the country in these, because there's a ton of farmers markets and a ton of arts festivals. I personally have reached out to a lot of them, and they're all exposure gigs. How do you monetize that exposure gig?
You monetize that exposure gig by having product, one. You monetize that exposure gig by maximizing said exposure. Say I'm playing a gig for nothing. How am I gonna get something out of it? Well, I can set up a camera. I can get good video out of it. That will bring me money eventually. I could record said gig, same way. I could bring t-shirts, I could bring my CD. I could hand my card to someone who could call me later and be like, hey, I work for Wells Fargo and we're having a big party. How much would it cost for you to come and play? Those things happen at those exposure gigs.
You can also collaborate with someone. It is a perfect time to find a musician outside of your network and call them up. Maybe it's Saturday, 10 o'clock in the morning, and they got nothing going on. Invite them out. Play a song together with them. Collaborate. Network with other musicians. That's how, utilize what Brimer said and use those free exposure gigs, because you can make money out of them. If you really want to get your original music out, think like a marketer, think like a business person. So before we wrap this up, what's in store for 2018?
Okay, so right now what's in store is my next record, which is called Hand Signals, will be out in February. So that's the next creative thing. But more than anything, 2018 is about gigs. I'm going to be everywhere. I'm going to be... You will have a hard time missing me, because we're going to be... there's going to be, obviously, corporate gigs that we're working on. More tours planned for later in the year. We're just... This is the year of big exposure, you know?
There is also one other thing that Samuel and Brimer have in store for you guys.
Well, we're working on a project now that it's going to be like a guidebook.
It is going to be called the... We don't actually know the name right now, but we are working on it. And it's called... going to be a game plan for musicians. But it's going to be a game plan like no one's ever seen before. And we are going to focus on getting your creativity out on paper and thinking outside the box and not going with the standard music industry. We are hoping, our goal is to have that completed by the end of the year. And if I'm going to do it with anyone, I'm going to do it with someone who was able to accomplish so much in 2017.
Yeah, basically what we want to do is we want to take the things that we've learned from
our mistakes, you
know, years and years and years of being in the industry, things that our peers have learned and their mistakes, and try and make a practical guidebook for a practical working musician. This isn't going to be the kind of thing where 10 steps to become famous. This isn't that. This is how to succeed in what the music business is now.
It's the game plan. It's the focus pattern. It's the creativity, where if you don't know what you're doing every morning when you wake up, why the fuck would you succeed?
Exactly. Goals.
Set them. get them down on paper. Well, as always, Brimer, I appreciate your time, and I love, we could talk for hours on the music industry, and I'm probably sure we'll hang out afterwards and talk for hours on how to get more creative. Thank you very much for coming on episode 14. I will add all your music in the links. We'll get all that up. Show notes will be up. This episode will be aired on January 18th.
All right.
All right. I'm John Samuel with Hold That Thought, and I'm out.
See ya.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to episode 14 of Hold That Thought with David Brimer. I hope everyone enjoyed this episode and you found it beneficial. If you like what we're doing, do us a favor. Head over to the iTunes store and subscribe to the podcast. Hit us up on Twitter at HoldThat77. Follow us on Podomatic. Throw us a like. Recommend us. If you have any comments or feedback, you can do that on the Twitter channel at HoldThat77. Or you could send us an email at cjsevents1@gmail.com. My name's John Samuel with Hold That Thought, and I'm out.